a bad thing and keeps silent on the matter. He's not much for politics. He prefers the mystical realm. There was, Nanny observed, even some local support for Nessarose's plans. But since Nessarose governed her remarks well, the wizard's armed forces garrisoned in the area could find no excuse to arrest her. "She's adept at this," Nanny admitted. "She's taught her well. She stands on her own 2 feet now." The word adept sent chills down Elfie's spine. Was Nessarose even now responding to some sort of spell that Madame Morrible had placed on her, those foggy years ago in the parlor at Craige Hall? Was she in fact a pawn, an adept of the wizard, or of Madame Morrible? Did she know why she did what she did? For that matter, was Elphaba herself merely a playing piece of a higher evil power? The recollection of Madame Morrible's proposals for their careers, hers and Nessarose's and Glinda's, had come back to Elfie with a shock following the recovery of Lear from his saturation and near drowning last winter. When he finally came around enough to answer questions about how he had come to be in the fish well, he could only say, "The fish talked to me. She told me to come down." Elfie knew in her heart that it was Manic, horrible, evil Manic, who had tortured the boy unmercifully and openly all winter. She didn't care that Manic died, even if Manic was the precious son of Fiero. Any torturer was fair game for javelin icicles. But she had to pause, gulping, at what Lear had said next. He said, "The fish told me she was magic. She said that Fiero was my father, and that Irgi and Manic and Nor are my brothers and my sister." "Goldfish don't talk, sweetheart," Sarima said. "You're imagining things. You were down there too long, and your brain got waterlogged." Elphaba had yearned toward Lear, a strange, unhappy compulsion. Who was this boy who lived in her life? Oh, she knew more or less where he came from, but who he was, it seemed to make a difference for the first time in her life. She had reached out and put her hand on his shoulder. He had twitched it off. He was not used to such a gesture, and she had felt rebuffed. "Want to see my pet mouse, Weir?" said Nor, who had been warm to the boy during his convalescence. Lear always chose the company of his peers over questioning by the grown-ups, and it was impossible to pry further information out of him about his ordeal. He didn't seem much changed, except that with Manic dead, Lear charged around Kiamo Ko with greater zest and liberty. And Sarima had looked at Elphaba, and Elphaba thought the hour of her liberation was at hand at last. "How silly of the boy! He's delusional," Sarima had said at last. "The idea of Fiero being his father. Fiero didn't have an ounce of fat on his body, and look at the boy!" Under the terms of her welcome, Elphaba could not prod Sarima to change her mind, but she stared at her hostess, willing her to accept the facts. But she wouldn't. "And whoever might the mother be," said Sarima blandly, touching the hem of her skirt softly. "It's preposterous beyond words." For the first time, Elfie wished that Lear had at least an undertone of green in his skin. Sarima had swept away to weep in her chapel for her husband, for her second son. And the terms of Elfie's imprisonment, as an unwilling traitor, as an exiled Mont, as a hapless mother, as a failed insurrectionist, as a witch in disguise, remained unchanged. Though the idea of a goldfish or a carp in the fish well telling such things to Lear, was there any possibility in that? or had Madame Morrible the ability to change her shape, to live in cold darkness, to slip in and observe what Elfie was up to? Lear had no imagination to speak of. He couldn't have come up with that by himself, could he? When she went to look in the fish well, many times, at all hours of the day or night, the old carp, or carp, stayed out of sight. "I'm glad to hear Nessa Rose is on her 2 feet," said Elphaba at last, coming back to the orchard from her musings. Nanny was gnawing at a piece of sugar candy.
"I mean that literally, you know," said Nanny through her spittle. "She doesn't need to be propped up any more, not figuratively or literally. She can stand on her own, stand and sit."
"Without benefit of arms? I don't believe it," said the witch.
"You'll have to. Do you remember that pair of shoes that Frex had decorated for her?"
Of course Elphaba remembered. The beautiful shoes, her father's sign of devotion to his second daughter, his desire to accentuate her beauty and draw attention away from her deformity.
"Well, old Glinda of the Arduenas, remember her? Married to Sir Chuffrey, and gone a bit to seed, in my humble opinion. She came to Colwyn Grounds a couple of years ago. She and Nessa Rose had a wild old time remembering college days, and she put those very same shoes through something of an enchantment. Don't ask me. Magic was never my cup of tea. The shoes allowed Nessa Rose to sit and stand and walk without support. She is never without them. She claims they give her moral virtue, too, but then she has buckets more of that than she needs. You'd be surprised how superstitious Munchkinlanders have become these days," Nanny sighed. "That's why I was free to look you up, dearie. The magic shoes made me redundant. Nanny is out of a job."
"You're too old to work. You sit and enjoy the sun," said Elphaba. "You can stay here as long as you like."
"You talk as if this is your house," said Nanny, "as if you have the right to issue such invitations."
"Until I'm allowed to leave, this is my house," said Elfie. "I can't help it." Nanny shaded her eyes and looked out over the mountains, which in the midday light looked like polished horn.
"It's too rich to think of you being a witch, after a fashion anyway, and your sister trying out as resident saint. Who would have thought, back in those muddy years in the Quadling Badlands? I don't think you're a witch, whatever you say, but one thing I do want to know. Is Lear your son?"
Elphaba shivered, though her heart, deep inside its pocket of cold, roiled in hot energy.
"It is not a question I can answer," she said sadly. "You needn't keep anything from me, dearie. Remember, Nanny was nursemaid to your mother, too, and a more outgoing, sensual woman I have yet to meet. Convention didn't bind her, not in youth nor in married life."
"I don't think I want to hear about this," said Elfie.
"Then let's talk about Lear. What in blazes can you mean you can't answer a simple question like that? Either you conceived him and bore him, or you didn't. As far as I know, in this world, there are no other stories."
"What I mean," said Elphaba, "and the only remark about it I will ever make, is this. When I first went to the Monterey under the kind offices of Mother Yackel, I was in no state to know what was happening to me, and I spent about a year in a deathly sleep. It's just possible I brought a child to term and delivered it. I was another full year recovering. When I was first assigned duties, I worked with the sick and the dying, and also with abandoned children. I had no more congress with Lear than with any other of several dozen brats. When I left the Monterey to come here, it was under the condition that I would take Lear with me. I didn't question the instruction. One doesn't question the instructions of superiors.
I have no motherly warmth toward the boy." She gulped, in case this was no longer true. "And I don't feel as if I've ever gone through the experience of bearing a child. I don't quite believe myself capable, in fact, although I'm willing to concede that this may be simply ignorance and blindness. But that's all there is to say about it. I'll say no more, and no more will you." "Have you an obligation to be motherly to him, then, despite the mystery?" "The only other obligations I'm under are the ones I assign to myself, and that, Nanny, is that." "You are too tart. This situation makes you unhappy. But if you think I came here to raise yet another generation of throps, forget it. Nanny is in her senility now, remember, and happily so." But Elphaba couldn't help noting that in the weeks that followed, Nanny began to attend to Lear's needs more lovingly than she did the needs of Nor and Irgy. Elphaba registered it with shame, for she also saw how willingly Lear responded to Nanny's attention. In telling tales of Shell's derring do, her racy old heart pitter-pattering almost visibly beneath her breastbone, Nanny revealed details of the wizard's campaigns. It made Elphaba furious, for she had kept hoping to lose interest in the ways of evil men. Nanny buzzed on about the wizards having mounted a new kind of youth camp, the Emperor's Garden, a pretty euphemistic name. All Munchkinlander children from 4 to 10 were required to attend in month-long summer residences. The children were sworn to secrecy, a great game for them, no doubt. Nanny told a long-winded tale more suited to toothless cronies in a fireside ingle nook than to a dinner table with upright and repressed Arjiki spinsters, of how Shell, dear stranger brother Shell, disguised himself as a potato man doing deliveries, and got in the gates. Oh, la, the many amusing adventures of a rake! The camp general's newbuild daughter in Dezabil, Shell's inventive alibis, his dalliances, his narrow escapes, almost being discovered at his liaisons by children. What a lark! Nanny remained a mouthy old peasant at heart, despite her airs. Elphaba thought, she hardly comprehends she is talking about indoctrination, betrayal, forced conscription of children into low-level warfare. With Elfie's newfound awareness of Lear hovering at the edges of her life, bumbling gently through her days, she found these tales of indoctrinated children horrifying and repugnant. She went to the grimmery and hauled open its massive cover, leather ornamented with golden hasps and pins and tooled with silver leaf, and pored through the tome to find what makes people thirst for such authority and muscle. Is it the sheer nature of the beast within, the human animal inside the human being? She looked for a recipe for the overthrow of a regime. She found much on power and damage, but little on strategy. The grimmery described poisoning the lips of goblets, charming the steps of a staircase to buckle, agitating a monarch's favorite lapdog to make a fatal bite in an unwelcome direction. It suggested the nocturnal insertion through any convenient orifice of a fiendish invention, a thread like a piano wire, part tapeworm and part burning fuse, for a particularly painful demise. All of this seemed carnival sleight of hand to Elphaba. What was more interesting in her reading was a small drawing she saw next to a section marked Evil Particulars. The drawing, done, if you would believe gullible Sarima, in some world other than theirs, was a clever sketch of a broad-faced woman fiend. Written in an angular, bronchiating script with elegant tapering serifs,
all around the illustration, were the words, "Yackle snarling." Elphaba looked again. She saw a creature part woman, part grassland jackal, its jaws open, its hand paw lifted to rip the heart out of a spider web. And the creature reminded her of old Mother Yackal from the Monterey. Conspiracy theories, as Sarima had said, seemed to bedevil her thinking. She turned the page. Nothing in the grimoire on how to depose a tyrant, nothing useful. Armies of holy angels were not answerable to her. Nothing there that described why men and women could turn out so horrible, or so wonderful, if that ever happened any more. In truth, the family was devastated over Manic's death. There was an unspoken feeling that somehow Lear's life had been saved at the expense of Manic's. The sisters suffered from that most dreadful of losses, the theft of the adult Manic from their lives. Their sad lot had been bearable all these years because Manic was going to be the man Fiero had been, and maybe more. They realized in retrospect that they had expected Manic to restore the fallen fortunes of Kiamo Ko. Feckless Irgi had no more sense of destiny than a prairie dog, and Nor was a girl more flighty and distractible than usual. So Sarima, behind her gestures of ecstatic acceptance of life, its joys, its sorrows, its mysteries, as she was fond of elaborating, became more aloof. Never close to her sisters, she began to take her meals alone in the solar. Irgi and Nor, who had enjoyed a sort of allegiance from time to time against the headstrong malice of Manic, had less to bind them together now. Irgi began to moon about in the old Unionist chapel, teaching himself to read better by scrutinizing moldy hymnals and breviaries. Nor didn't like the chapel. She thought the ghost of Manic lingered there, as that was the last place she had seen his body in the unwrapped shroud. So she tried to ingratiate herself with Auntie Witch, but to no avail. "You are out to make mischief with Chistery," snapped Elfie, "and I've work to do. Go bother someone else." She aimed a kick at Nor, who, whimpering and screaming as if it had hit home, left in a funk. Nor took to wandering, now that the summer was coming in, down the high valley, the one with the stream at its bottom, and up the other side where the sheep were nibbling on the best grass they would get all year. In previous years, she would either have been with her brothers, or she would have been forbidden to go climbing alone. This year, no one was paying enough attention to her to forbid it. She wouldn't have minded being forbidden. She wouldn't have minded the strap, even. She was lonely. One day, she wandered particularly far down the valley, luxuriating in the strength and endurance of her strong legs. She was only 10, but a strapping, mature 10. She had hiked her green skirt up into her belt, and because the sun was high and strong, she had shucked off her blouse and tied it like a bandana around her head. She hardly had a swelling here or there on her chest with which to startle any sheep, and anyway she expected to be able to spot a shepherd from miles away. "How in the world did I come to be here, of all places in Oz?" she asked herself, freshly treading upon the terrain of reflection. "Here I am, a girl on a mountain, nothing but wind and sheep and grass, like an emerald brush fire, green and golden as Lurlinmus decorations, silky in the updraft, coarse in the downdraft. Just me and the sun and the wind. And that group of soldiers coming out from behind the rock." She slid down onto her back in the grass, fixed up her blouse, and raised herself to her elbows, hiding. They were not soldiers such as she had seen before. They were not Arjiki men in their ceremonial brasses and helmets, with their spears and shields. These were men in brown uniforms and caps, with muskets or something slung over their shoulders. They were wearing a kind of boot, rather high and inappropriate for hill-walking, and when one of them had stopped and was fiddling with a nail or a stone in his boot, his arm disappeared inside it right up to his elbow. There was a green stripe down the front of their uniforms and a bar across it, and Nor felt cold with an unfamiliar sense of anticipation. At the same time, she wanted to be seen. What would Manik have done? She asked herself. Irgi would run, Lear would puzzle and dither, but Manik? Manik would have marched right up to them and found out what was going on. And so would she. She checked once again to make sure her buttons were done up, and then she strode down the slope toward them. By the time she had got all their attention, and the man with the boot had slipped it back on, she was beginning to rethink the wisdom of the plan. But it was too late to run away now. "Hail," she said in a formal way, using the language of the East, not her own Arjiki vernacular. "Hail and halt! I am the princess daughter of the Arjikis, and this is my valley you're marching your big black boots along." It was broad noon when she delivered them into the castle keep of Kiamo Ko. The sisters were in their summer laundry yard, beating carpets themselves because they didn't trust the local scrub wives to treat them respectfully enough. The sound of boots on cobbles brought the sisters running through an archway, all flushed and dusty, their hair wrapped in cotton scarves. Elphaba heard the noise, too, and threw her window open and stared. "Not an inch farther until I come down," she called, "or I'll turn you all to rodents. Nor, come away from them. All of you, come away."
"I shall fetch the Dowager Princess," said Tu, "if it please you, gentlemen."
But by the time Sarima arrived, drowsy from a nap, Elphaba had descended, her broom over her shoulder, her eyebrows up to her scalp.
"You have no invitation here," said Elfie,
looking more like a witch than ever in her montish skirts.
"So just how welcome would you like to be made? Who is in charge here? You? Who's the senior one leads this mission? You?"
"If you please, madam," said someone,
a strapping Gilikinese man of about 30.
"I am the commander. The name is Cherrystone, and I'm under the Emperor's orders to requisition a house large enough to shelter our party while we are in this district of the Kells. We are doing a survey of the passes to the Thousand-Year Grasslands." He produced a sweat-stained document from inside his shirt.
"I found them, Auntie Witch," said Nor proudly.
"Go away, go inside," said Elphaba to the girl.
"You men aren't welcome here, and the girl has no right to invite you. Turn around and march yourself out over that drawbridge at once."
Noor's face fell.
"This is not a request, it is an order," said Commander Cherrystone in an apologetic tone.
"This isn't a suggestion, it's a warning," said Elphaba. "Go or suffer the consequences."
Sarima by now had taken in enough to step forward, her sisters buzzing in a thrill around her.
"Auntie Guest," she said,
"you forget the code of the mountains, the same code by which you came to lodge here, and your old nanny after you. We do not turn visitors away. Please, sirs, excuse our excitable friend, and excuse us. It has been some time since we saw soldiers in uniform." The sisters were primping away as best they could at such short notice.
"I won't have it, Sarima," Elphaba said. "You've never been out of here. You don't know who these men are or what they will do. I won't have it, do you hear?"
"It's the high spirits, the determination. It makes her so much fun to have around," said Sarima a little meanly, as in general she really did enjoy Elphaba's company. But she did not like having her authority usurped.
"Gentlemen, this way. I'll show you where you can wash up."
Irji wasn't sure what to make of military men and wouldn't go very near. Whether he was afraid of being conscripted or enchanted, he couldn't say. He dragged a sleeping roll down into the chapel and slept there, now that it was warm enough. It was Nanny's opinion he was going weird.
"Believe me, after a life looking after your dear mother's devout husband, Frex, and your sister after that, I know a religious lunatic when I see one," she said to Elphaba. "That boy ought to be taking some lessons from these men in manliness, whatever else is going on here."
On the other hand, Lear was in heaven. He followed Commander Cherrystone around, unless he was turned back, and he fetched water for the men and polished their boots, in a surfeit of ill-concealed romance. The tramping they did, reconnoitering about the local valleys, mapping the places to ford the river, pinpointing spots for beacons, gave Lear more exercise and fresh air than he had ever had before. His spine, which had threatened to become curved like the arc of a mountain harp, seemed to straighten out. The soldiers were indifferent to him, but they were not manifestly unkind, and Lear took this as approval and fondness. The sisters regained some sense when they stopped to consider what class of men would go into the army, but it wasn't easy. Sarima alone seemed unperturbed by the disturbance to their routine. She cast about among the villagers and called in favors to help her feed the host of soldiers. And in mixed resentment and fear, her neighbors came up with milk, eggs, cheese, and vegetables. There was stouch or garmut from the fish well almost every evening, and the summer game, of course, quail, hill fennex, baby rock, which the men proved a dab hand at bringing in themselves. Nanny suspected that the reconnaissance team was helping Sarima over her grief, bringing her back to the family table at least. But Elphaba was furious at them all. She and the commander had words every day. Elphi forbade him to allow Lear to tag along, and she forbade Lear himself, to absolutely no effect. Her first true motherly feelings were of incompetence and of being blithely ignored as inconsequential. She could not understand how the human race had ever managed to develop past a single generation. She continually wanted to strangle Lear as a means of saving him from smooth-talking father figures. As Elphi tried harder to ferret out the nature of his mission, with every sidestepping pleasantry, Commander Cherrystone grew more icy and polite. The one thing Elphaba had never been able to manage was a parlor manner, and this soldier of all people was a master at it. It made her feel as she had felt among the society girls at Crage Hall. "Pay those soldiers no mind, they'll go away eventually," said Nanny, who was at the time of her life when everything was either the final fatal crisis or a dismissible matter indeed. Sarima says that she has rarely seen any of the wizard's forces in the Vincas. This was always arid, lifeless, of little interest to the farmers and merchants of northern and eastern Oz. The tribes have lived here for decades, centuries, I suppose, with nothing but the occasional cartographer passing through and beating a quick retreat. Don't you think this suggests some sort of campaign in these parts? What else can it suggest? Look at how long it has taken these young men to recuperate from their overland trek, said Nanny. This is surely just a reconnaissance mission, as they say. They'll get their information and then leave. Besides, everyone is always telling me the whole damn place is swamped in snow or mud for 2/3 of the year. You're a worrier. You always were.
the way you gripped the quadlings we used to proselytize as if they were your own private dolls, how you went on when they were relocated or whatever. It used to trouble your mother no end, believe me. It's been well documented that the quadlings were being exterminated, and we were witnesses, said Elphaba strictly. You too, Nanny. I look after my young. I can't look after the world, said Nanny, quaffing a cup of tea and scratching Killyjoy's nose. I look after Lear, which is more than you do.
Elphaba didn't think it worth her while to lambaste the old biddy. She flipped through the grimoire again, trying to find some small spell of binding with which she could close the castle gates against the men. She wished she had at least sat in on Miss Grayling's class in magic at school.
"Of course, your mother was worried about you. She always was," said Nanny. "You were such an odd little thing, and the trials that poor woman had. You remind me of her now, only you're more rigid than she was. She could really let her hair down. Do you know, she was so upset with having you be a girl, she was so convinced you'd be a boy, she sent me to the Emerald City to find an elixir to ensure—" But Nanny stopped, muddled. "Or was that elixir to prevent her next child from being born green?" "Yes, that was it."
"Why did she want me to be a boy?" said Elphaba. "I would have obliged her if I'd had a say in the matter. Not to be simplistic, but it always made me feel horrible to know how I'd disappointed her so early on. Not to mention the looks."
"Oh, don't credit her with nasty motives," said Nanny. She eased her shoes off and rubbed the backs of her feet with her cane. "Melina had hated her life at Colwyn Grounds, you know. That's why she contrived to fall in love with Frex and get out of there. Her grandfather, the eminent Throp, had made it all too clear that she would inherit the title. The Munchkinlander title descends through the female line unless there are no daughters. The family seat and all its attendant responsibilities would go from him to Lady Partra, to Melina, and then to the first daughter Melina had. She was hoping to have only sons, to keep them out of that place."
"She always talked about it so lovingly," said Elphaba, astounded.
"Oh, everything is gorgeous once it's gone. But for a young person trained up in all that wealth and responsibility, well, she hated it. She revolted by having sex early and often with anyone who would oblige, and she as good as ran off with Frex, who was the first suitor she had who loved her for herself and not her position and inheritance. She thought a daughter of hers would find it equally deadly, so she wanted sons."
"But that makes no sense. If she had sons and no daughters, then her oldest son would inherit. If I'd been a boy without sisters, I'd still have been stuck in the same mess."
"Not necessarily," said Nanny. "Your mother had one older sister who was born with a permanent case of overwrought nerves, maybe also lacking in the brains department. She was housed off grounds. But she was old enough to breed, and healthy enough, and was just as likely to bear a daughter. If she had borne a daughter first, her daughter would have inherited the title of eminence, and the estate and fortunes with it."
"So I have a mad aunt," said the witch.
"Maybe madness runs in the family. Where is she now?" "Died of the flu when you were still a small child, and left no issue. So Melina's hopes were dashed. But that was her thinking back in those brash, brave days of youthful blunder."
Elphaba had few memories of her mother, and they were warm, sometimes searing.
"But what's this about her taking medicine to prevent Nessa Rose from being born green?" I got her some tablets in the Emerald City from some gypsy woman, said Nanny. I explained to the beastly creature what had happened. I mean that you'd been born an unfortunate color. And those teeth! Thank Lurleen, your second set were more human. And the gypsy woman made some silly prophecy about two sisters being instrumental in the history of Oz. She gave me some powerful pills. I've always wondered if the pills were the cause of Nessa Rose's affliction. I wouldn't mess with gypsy potions any more, believe me. Not with what we know these days.
She smiled, having long ago forgiven herself of any culpability in the whole affair.
Nessa Rose's affliction, mused Elphaba. Our mother took some gypsy remedy and bore a second daughter without arms. It was either green or armless. Mama didn't have very good luck at girls, did she?
Shell, however, is a sight for sore eyes, said Nanny rosily. Then who is to say it was all your mother's fault? First there was the confusion about who was really Nessa Rose's father, and then the pills from that old yackle person, and your father's moodiness.
Yackle person? What do you mean? Asked Elphaba, starting. And who the hell was Nessa Rose's father, if it wasn't Papa?
Oh, la, said Nanny. Pour me another cup of tea, and I'll tell you all. You're old enough now, and Melina's long dead.
She meandered through a story about the quaddling glassblower named Turtleheart, and Melina's uncertainty whether Nessa Rose was his child or Frex's, and the visit to Yackle, about whom she could remember nothing else but the name, the pills, and the prophecy. Can't pull teeth from a hen, so stop trying. She didn't mention, and she never had, how depressed Melina became when Elphaba was born. There was no point. Elfie listened to all this, impatient and annoyed. On the one hand, she wanted to throw it out the window. The past was immaterial. On the other, things fell into a slightly different order now. And that Yackle, was the name just a coincidence? She was tempted to show Nanny the picture of Yackle snarling in the grimoire, but resisted. No sense alarming the old woman or giving her the nighttime frights. So the two women poured each other tea and restrained themselves from painful observations about the past. But Elphaba began to fret about Nessa Rose. Perhaps Nessie didn't want the position of eminence and was just as incarcerated there as her older sister was here. Perhaps Elphaba owed her the chance of liberty. Yet how much really could you owe other people? Was it endless? Nor was beside herself. In a short time her whole life had changed so utterly. The world was more magic than ever, but it seemed lodged inside her now, not outside. Her body was waiting to flame, to blossom, and no one seemed to care or to notice. Lear had become a water boy for the expeditionary soldiers. Irgi spent his time composing long devotional libretti in honor of Lurleena. In a state of uncertainty over the men in residence, the sisters remained confined to their chambers by their own inclination, yet quivering with readiness should things change. Nothing could change, as convention dictated, unless Sarima married again, and then they would be free to court. Their domestic campaigns to throw Commander Cherrystone and Sarima together, however, met with no success. They redoubled their efforts. Three even approached Auntie Witch for a love potion from that magic encyclopedia.
Ha! Said Elphaba. That'll be the day. And that was that about that.
nor, bereft of companionship, took to hanging around the men's dormitory, trying to pitch in with chores that Lear wasn't asked to do, that men didn't much care about. She hung out their cloaks in the sun. She polished their buttons. She brought them flowers from the hills. She prepared a tray of summer fruits and cheeses that seemed to please them, especially when she served them herself. One young, dark, balding soldier, with a captivating smile, liked her to pop the orange segments right in his lips, and he sucked the juice from her fingers, to the mingled enjoyment and envy of the others. "Sit on my lap," he said, "and let me feed you." He offered her a strawberry, but she wouldn't sit on his lap, and she loved refusing. One day she decided to treat them to a full-scale chamber cleaning. They were out doing an inventory of the vineyards on the lower slopes, and would be gone all day. Nor arrayed herself with rags, yoked herself with buckets, and since Auntie Witch was deep in conversation with Nanny about, it seemed, Sarima, Nor swiped the witch's broom for its thicker brush and longer handle. She headed to the barracks. She couldn't read much, so she ignored the letters and maps that spilled from the leathern satchels left carelessly slung over the back of a chair. She tidied the trunks and swept, and in the effort raised a lot of dust and felt warm. She took off her blouse and slung one of the men's rough capes over her sun-browned shoulders. It gave off such a heady aroma of maleness, even after its airing, that she nearly swooned. She lay down on someone's pallet with the cape just slightly falling open so that she could imagine falling asleep and having the men return and see the beautiful line of flat skin that ran between her fresh new breasts. She considered pretending to fall asleep, but she knew she wouldn't do this. She sat up, dissatisfied with the possibilities, and reached out to grab the nearest thing. It happened to be the broom, so she could whack something in frustration. The broom was out of reach, but it lunged a little toward her. It came across the floor of its own accord. She saw it. The broom was magic. She touched it almost fearfully, as if she guessed it had intentions. It felt no different from an ordinary broom. It merely moved, as if guided by the hand of an invisible spirit. "What tree are you whittled from? What field are you mown from?" she asked it, almost tenderly. But she expected no answer, and she got none. The broom quivered and elevated itself a little off the floor, as if waiting. The cape had a hood on it, and she drew this up over her face. Then she hiked her summer skirt to her knees and threw one leg over the broom to ride it as a child rides a hobby horse. The thing rose tentatively so she could keep her balance by trailing her toes on the floor, correcting, correcting. The center of gravity was high, and the span was so narrow. The top of the handle tilted farther up, and she slid down the shaft until she was caught against the brush top, as if it were a saddle of sorts. She held on tightly. Her legs, especially in the upper thigh, felt as if they were swelling, the better to clench the handle between them. The large window at the end of the room hung open for air and light, and the broom moved a couple of feet across the floor until it had reached the sill. Then the broom rose a few feet and carried her out the window. Nora's stomach pitched, and her heels beat against the underside of the brush. Mercifully, she had emerged not in the castle courtyard, where she would likely be seen, but on the other side, where the land did not fall away quite so far and fast. Nor wailed softly in the strangeness and ecstasy of the adventure. The cape flared out, exposing her chest, and how could she ever have imagined she wanted to be seen without a blouse? "Oh, oh!" she cried, but whether to the broom or to some guardian spirit she did not know. She shuddered with exposure and shock, and the broom rose higher and higher until it had come to a level with the uppermost window, which was in the witch's tower. The witch and her nanny were watching, open-mouthed, with cups of tea halfway to their lips. "You come down from there at once," ordered the witch, nor didn't know if it was she who was being addressed or the broom. She had no reins to tug, no words of magic to wield. However, the broom, apparently chastened, turned back, descended, and made a somewhat clumsy landing on the floor of the men's barracks. Nor flung herself off, weeping and shivering, and reclothed herself properly. She didn't want to touch the broom again, but when she picked it up, the life had gone out of it, and she carried it up to the witch's apartments, expecting a severe reprimand. "What were you doing with my broom?" barked the witch. "I was cleaning the soldiers' quarters," gabbled Noor. "It's such a mess, their papers all over, their clothes, their maps." "Keep your hands off my things, you," said the witch. "What kinds of papers?" "Plans, maps, letters, I don't know," said Noor, regaining her spunk. "Go look for yourself. I didn't pay attention." The witch took the broom and appeared to consider hitting Noor with it. "Don't be a fool, Noor. Stay away from those men," she said coldly. "Stay away from them!" She raised the broom like a truncheon. "They'll hurt you as soon as spit at you. Stay away from them, I say, and stay away from me." Elphaba remembered that the broom was given her by Mother Yackel. The young woman had seen the old Mont as crippled, senile, a bother, but now Elphaba looked back and wondered if there was more to her than met the eye. Was that broom magicked by Mother Yackel with a vestige of some cambrecial instinct? Or did Noor have a power developing in her, and did she bring it out in the senseless broom? Noor apparently was a fervid believer in magic. Maybe the broom was waiting to be believed in. Would it fly for Elphaba, too? One night, when everyone else had retired, Elphaba brought the broom out to the courtyard. She felt a little foolish, crouching down on the broom like a child on a hobby horse. "Come on, fly, you fool thing," she muttered. The broom twitched back and forth in a naughty way, enough to raise welts in her inner thighs. "I'm not a blushing schoolgirl. Stop that nonsense," said Elphaba. The broom rose a foot and a half and then dumped Elfie on her rear end. "I'll set you afire, and that'll be the end of you," said Elphaba. "I'm too old for this sort of indignity." It took 5 or 6 nights of trying before she managed even to hover 6 feet off the ground. She had been useless in sorcery. Was she doomed to be useless at everything? It was a pleasure, finally, to scare the barn owls and bats senseless, and it was good to be abroad. When she had more confidence, she wobbled far down the valley to the remains of the Ozma Regent's attempt at a dam. She rested and hoped that she wouldn't have to walk back. She didn't. The broom was resistant to her intention, but she could always threaten it with fire. She felt like a night angel. In midsummer, an Arjikit trader came along with pots and spoons and spools of thread, and he carried with him some letters left at an outpost farther north. Among them was a note from Frex. Apparently Nanny had told him of her intentions to hunt Elphaba down, and he wrote to the Monterey, which had forwarded the letter on to Kiamo Ko in the Vincas. Frex wrote that Nessa Rose had orchestrated a revolt, and that Munchkin Land, or most of it anyway, had seceded from Oz and set itself up as an independent state. Nessa Rose, as the eminent Throp, had become the political head of state. Frex apparently thought this was Elphaba's birthright, and that she should come to Colwyn Grounds and challenge her sister for it. "It may be she isn't the right woman for the job," he wrote, though Elphaba found his apprehension surprising. Wasn't Nessa Rose the warmly spiritual daughter that Elphie could never be? Elphaba had no thirst for leadership, and did not want to challenge Nessa Rose in any way. But now that the broom seemed able to carry her for long distances, she wondered if she could fly by night to Colwyn Grounds, and spend a few days seeing Papa, Nessie, and Shell once again. It had been a dozen years since she left Nessie and Shiz, drunk and sobbing following the death of Amma Clutch. For Munchkinland to be free of the wizard's iron grip, that alone would be worth the trip. It made Elphie grin a bit at herself to feel her old contempt for the wizard flare up. Perhaps this was what healing meant, after all. To be safe, one afternoon, Elphaba went through the soldiers' empty barracks. She pored through their papers. All the documents related to issues of mapping and geological survey, nothing else. There seemed to be no hidden agenda of threat to the Arjikis or the other Vincas tribes. The earlier she went, the sooner she would return, and it would be better if no one knew. So she told everyone she was taking a period of isolation in her tower, and she wanted neither food nor visitors for some days. When midnight struck, she set out for Colwyn Grounds, now the home of her powerful sister. She slept by daylight in the shadows of barns, the overhang of eaves, the lee of chimneys. She traveled by night. In the gloom, Oz spread out below. She hovered above it at about 80 feet, near as she could reckon. And the countryside made its geographical transformations with the ease of a vaudeville backdrop on rollers. The hardest passage was down the steep flanks of the Great Kells. Once free of the mountains, however, she saw Oz level out into the rich alluvial plain of the Gilliken River. She flew along the waterway, above trading vessels and islands, until it fed at last into Restwater, Oz's largest lake. She kept to its southern edge, and took a whole night to traverse it, as it endlessly lapped in black oily silk waves into sedge and swamp. She had trouble finding the mouth of the Munchkin River, which drained into Restwater from the eastern direction. Once she did, though, it was easy to locate the yellow brick road. The farmland beyond grew even more lush. The effects of the drought, so drastic in her childhood, had been eradicated, and dairy farms and small villages seemed to prosper, happy as a child's toy town set, cunning and cozy in the wrinkled, nappy land of arable soil and accommodating climate. The farther east she went, however, the more torn up the highway became. Crowbars had pried out bricks, trees had been felled, and brush walls erected. It looked as if a few of the smaller bridges had been dynamited. A safeguard against retaliation by the wizard's army? 7 days after leaving her chambers at Kiamo Koh, Elphaba flew into the hamlet of Colwyn Grounds and slept under a green bay tree. When she awoke, she asked a merchant for the great house, and he tremblingly pointed her the way, as if she were a demon. "So a green skin still gives Munchkinlanders the creeps," she observed, and walked the last couple of miles, and arrived at the front gates of Colwyn Grounds a little after breakfast. She had heard her mother speak of Colwyn Grounds, wistfully and angrily, as they had slopped in waterproof boots through 6 inches of Quadling country water. Elfie's years in the smug antiquity of Shiz and the pomp of the Emerald City ought to have prepared her for an imposing mansion. But she was startled, even shocked, at the grandeur of Colwyn Grounds. The gate was gilded, the forecourt swept clean of every scrap of grass and dung, and a bank of topiary saints in terracotta pots lined the balcony above the massive front door. Dignitaries with ribbons denoting new rank and prestige in the free state of Munchkinland, she guessed, stood in small groups to one side. Coffee cups in hand, the officials had apparently just finished an early morning Privy Council meeting. Inside the gate, swordsmen stepped neatly up and barred her way. She began to protest, instantly branded a menace and a loon, she could see, and she was about to be ejected when a figure wandered into view from around the corner of a folly and called for them to stop. "Fabula," he said. "Yes, Papa, I'm here," she answered, with a child's politeness. She turned. The dignitaries paused in their discussions, and then resumed, as if realizing that overhearing this reunion would be the height of rudeness. The guards withdrew their barrier when Frex approached. His hair was thin and long, and caught up by a rawhide implement, as it always had been. His beard was the color of cream, and reached his waist when he took his hands away from it.
"This is the Sister of the Eminence of the East," said Frex, staring at Elphaba, "and my oldest daughter. Let her pass through, dear men, now and every time she approaches." He reached and caught her hand, and turned his head as a bird might to see her through one capable eye. The other eye, she realized, was dead. "Come, we will greet each other in private, away from this attention," said Frex. "My word, Fabula, you have become your mother in these long years." He linked his arm into hers, and they went into the building through a side door and found a small salon done up in saffron silks and plum velvet cushions. The door closed behind them. Frex lowered himself cautiously to the sofa and patted the upholstery next to him. She sat down, weary, tired, astonished at the wealth of her own feeling for him. She was full of need, but she reminded herself, "You're a grown woman." "I knew you would come if I wrote," he said. "Fabula, I always knew that." He wrapped her in his arms stiffly. "I may cry for a minute." When he was through, he asked her where she had gone, and what she had done, and why she had never come back. "I was not sure there was a back to come to," she answered, realizing the truth of it as she spoke. "When you finished converting a town, Papa, you moved on to new fields. Your home was in the pasture of souls. Mine never was. Besides, I had my own work to do," she added a moment later in a low voice, "or I thought I did." She mentioned her years in the Emerald City, but did not say why. "And was Nanny right? Were you a Mont? I didn't raise you for such submission," he said. "I'm surprised. Such conformity and obedience." "I was no more a Mont than I ever was a Unionist," she chided him gently. "But I lived with the Monts. They did good work, whatever the error or inspiration of their beliefs. It was a time of recuperation from a difficult passage. And then last year I went to the Vincas, and I guess I've made my home there, although for how long I cannot say." "And what do you do?" he said. "Are you married?" "I'm a witch," she answered. He recoiled, peered through the working eye to see if she spoke in jest.
"Tell me about Nessie before I see her, and Shell," she said. "Your letter sounded as if you thought she needed help. I'll do what I can in the short while I can be here." He told her about her sister's rise to eminence and the secession in the late spring. "Yes, yes, I know of it, but not why," she said, prodding. So he described the burning of a grange where opposition meetings had been gathering, the reported rape of a couple of Munchkinlander made